Good morning. I invite you to remember with me today that as Unitarian Universalists, we do not hold any text as infallible, even our sacred texts, and I want you to keep that in mind as you look at your order of service today, because I invite you to think of it as a list of suggestions and possibilities. It's not exactly the way things are going to go. Our worship associate today could not be here, so you're stuck with me. Our chalice lighting this morning is going to be done by my daughter, Cadison. She's graciously agreed to light the chalice. Cadison has patiently listened to me preach versions of this grace sermon all across the Midwest, and I thought that for coming with me again today, the least I can do is let her play with fire.
Please affirm with me our covenant printed in our order of service. Love is the spirit of this church, and reason is its guide, to dwell together in peace, to seek truth and freedom, and to serve human need. This is our covenant.
Words of Andrew Kennedy, we come to love a church, the traditions, the history, and especially the people associated with it. And through these people, young and old, known and unknown, we reach out, both backward into history and forward into the future, to link together the generations in this imperfect but blessed community of memory and hope.
My age, your time. Good morning. The story I have for you today is called The Keeping Quill. When my great-grandma Anna came to America, she wore the same thick overcoat and big boots that she had worn for farm work. But her family weren't dirt farmers anymore. In New York City, her father's work was hauling things on a wagon, and the rest of the family, we made artificial flowers all day. Everyone was in a hurry, and it was so crowded. Not like back home in Russia, but all the same, it was their home, and most of the neighbors were just like them. When Anna went to school, English sounded to her like pebbles dropping into shallow water. In 6 months, she was speaking English. Her parents almost never learned, so she spoke English for them too. The only things that she had left from back home Russia were her dress and her babushka. She liked to throw it up in the air while she was dancing. And when her dress was getting too small, after her mother had sewn a new one, she took her old dress and her babushka. And from a basket of old clothes, she took Uncle Vladimir's shirt, Aunt Havilia's nightdress, and an apron of Aunt Natasha's. "We will make a quilt so that we always remember home," Anna's mother said. "It will be like having the family in the back home Russia dance around us here at night." And so it was. Anna's mother invited all the neighbor ladies, and they cut out animals and flowers from the scraps of clothing. Anna kept the needles threaded and handed them to the ladies when they needed them. The border of the quilt was made from Anna's babushka. On Friday nights, Anna's mother would say prayers and start the Sabbath. The family ate challah and chicken soup, and the quilt was the tablecloth. Anna grew up and fell in love with great-grandpa Sasha. To show he wanted to be her husband, he gave Anna a gold coin, a dried flower, and a piece of rock salt, all tied into a linen handkerchief. The gold was for wealth, the flower for love, and the salt so that their lives would have flavor. She accepted the hanky, and they were engaged. Under the wedding huppah, Anna and Sasha promised each other love and understanding, and after the wedding, the men and the women celebrated separately. When Grandpa Carl was born, Anna wrapped her daughter in the quilt to welcome her warmly into the world. Carly was given a gift of gold, flour, salt, so she would always know love, salt so her life would be flavorful, and bread so she would never be hungry. Carly learned to keep Sabbath and to cook and to do washing. "Married you'll be some days," Anna told Carly, and again, the quilt became the wedding huppah, this time for Carly's wedding to Grandpa George. Men and women, they celebrated together this time, but they did not dance together. In Carly's wedding bouquet, there was a gold coin, bread, and salt. Oops. Sorry about that. Carly and George moved to a farm in Michigan, and great-grandma Anna came to live with them. The quilt once again wrapped a new little girl, this time Mary Ellen. Mary Ellen called Anna Lady Grandma, and she'd grown very old and was sick a lot of the time, and the quilt kept her legs warm. On Anna's 98th birthday, the cake was a rich cake with raisins and candied fruit in it. And when great-grandma died, prayers were said to lift her soul to heaven, and my mother, Mary Ellen, was now the grown-up. When Mary Ellen left home, she took the quilt with her. And when she became a bride, the quilt became her huppah once again. For the first time, friends, not Jews, came to the wedding. My mother, she wore a suit, but in her bouquet, there was gold and bread and salt. The quilt welcomed me, Patricia, into the world. And it was the tablecloth for my very first birthday. At night, I would trace my fingers around the edges of each animal on the quilt before I went to sleep. I told my mother stories about the animals on the quilt, and she told me whose sleeve had made the horse, and whose apron had made the chicken, and whose dress had made the flowers, and whose babushka went all the way around the edge of the quilt. The quilt was a pretend cape when I was a ballerina or a bullring, and sometimes a tent in the steaming Amazon jungle. And at my wedding, to Enzo Mario, men and women danced together, and in my bouquet there was gold and bread and salt and a sprinkle of wine, so I would always know laughter. And 20 years ago, I held Tracy Denise in the quilt for the first time. Someday, she too will leave home, and she will take this quilt with her. The end. Please join us in singing Our Children Downstairs for Religious Education. The hymn is 118, This Little Light of Mine.
Keep singing together. If you would stand in body or spirit, we're going to sing number 1008 in your teal hymnal, When Our Heart Is in a Holy Place. Our reading today is by Richard S. Gilbert, and it's called For Those Who Have Reared Us. We give thanks for those who have reared us, who have nourished us through sleepless nights and restless days, who have seen us through the good times and the bad, who have celebrated our triumphs and suffered through our defeats. We are grateful for their nurturing spirit, their gentle touch, and their firm hand, their familiar laugh, and their sympathetic tears. We acknowledge the unpleasant times as well, our struggle to separate ourselves as children who must make their own way in the world. We realize our times of ingratitude and selfishness and resolve to make amends. We pay silent tribute to the loved ones no longer among us and speak soft thanksgivings to those who are. May we who have been nurtured also be nurturers of those who follow. May we be part of that current of humanity that courses through time and space. May we be gardeners of the Spirit, even as we have been tended by loving hearts and hands. May we commingle gratitude for those who nourished us with commitment to those who receive gifts of life and love from us. May we be worthy. When I was discussing with my teaching pastor, Sean Dennison, the monthly theme of ancestry for November, and particularly this sermon, which I preached a version of 2 weeks ago at my internship congregation in McHenry, I told him immediately, this might be a stretch to connect, but I really want to preach about grace. It just seemed like the only sermon for that particular Sunday. And at the time, I didn't really know why. Of course, we never know the complete why of the mysterious ways in which spirit sometimes moves. I certainly didn't know at the time that just how deeply I would need a sermon on grace this month. I knew that coming to a place of gratitude for those who raised me and those who raised them is an ongoing journey for me in, as Richard Gilbert wrote in our reading today, the struggle to separate ourselves as children who must make their own way in the world. In the past few weeks, I have watched my own parents come together to support my child in being her best self when I most needed to step back and learn grace lessons from a different perspective. I learned that the answer to the question of offering grace is a resounding yes from my parents to my daughter in a way that wasn't quite the case when it came to their full acceptance of me. Sometimes grace seems to skip a generation, but not really. Because now I get to be the one who witnesses their love for my child and then writes about it and preaches about it. I get to preach from a heart that is in a holy enough place to say in wonder, of course, how could we possibly have an entire month devoted to ancestry without talking about the grace that has held it all together? I struggle still with the concept of grace. What is it? What is it not? How does it show up or not in my life that is different from how it shows up or not in the lives of believers, and believers in what exactly? How do I share with you about it when the resounding answer in my own soul to all of these questions is, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know whether you have come to this place of worship today in a sweet state of grace, an agitated state of disgruntled content, grieving, angry, seeking or hurting, guarded or vulnerable. No matter where your heart happens to land in the midst of those words, let me say that what I do know is that your presence here is grace in and of itself, and I hold it sacred. And I thank you. I hold it sacred and I thank you because, as more of you here than anywhere else already know, I've not always known that it was possible for me to be standing before you. Because I come from a religious tradition where women are admonished to keep silence in the assembly, and the closest a young girl could ever come to, in aspirations to the ministry, were to learn to play the piano, teach the very young children in Sunday school, or play their cards right and marry a preacher. We learned all about sitting in a ladylike fashion, being gracious and graceful, and singing Amazing Grace that saved a wretch like me, and being grateful for the saving, which I was, I really was, until I wasn't. Therein lies a conversion tale, which is long and endlessly interesting to probably exactly one of us in this room. So I will cut to the part where I, in my unwed state of motherhood, heard that familiar hymn for the first time after the birth of my daughter, and I had one of the most pivotal theological shifts of my life thus far. I had already strayed from the church, to be sure. I was dabbling in the heresy of Unitarian Universalism and in the idea that maybe I would not define myself always as a backslider, which is what all of us who have fallen away from the Pentecostal faith are called by the still faithful. It's a sad, defeated, not very hope-filled label. And many can only shake it off by returning to the fold. I had wondered many times if that would be me. Until that day when somebody inadvertently sang that song in front of a hormonally whacked out new mother and may or may not have insinuated that my precious child was born a wretched sinner. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. Didn't sit well. It was a moment of never turning back. I had gone to church with my parents that morning, the church of my childhood and youth, the place where everybody knew my name and everybody knew my shame. I was sitting between my mom and dad, holding their newest grandbaby in my arms, and in a single second, I knew that I had to get her out of there. As the saints sang with their whole hearts, I stood up, tears rushing down my face, and made my way to the aisle with my tiny little bundle of perfection, and I walked in the opposite direction of that those who were praying for my soul had hoped. I left the sanctuary and walked hurriedly to the nursery, sobbing in deep gasps. The grave misfortune and error of the doctrine of original sin was revealed in my soul in a way that I had never before really seen. And I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that my baby was not born a sinner in need of forgiveness. Maybe all those other people in there had given birth to wretched babies, but not me. My baby was perfect, beloved, divine, born exactly right the first time and not in need of any saving. Yes, this kid right here, born to screwed up, shameful me and a father I had barely known, conceived out of nothing but youthful rebellion and irresponsibility. And yet here she was, perfect and beautiful and glowing with a spark of divinity. And if that ain't a whole lot of grace right there, I don't know what is. So I was angry. I wasn't just a little bit mad, I was pissed off. I was angry at my own mother for not having been able to stand up to the fearful dogma growling in her own ears and to be able to look at me and see that I too was born already filled with grace and perfection. I was angry that I grew up with wretch mentality, wretched lies, wretched guilt and shame, and I'd forgotten who I was born to be. Or had I ever even known? I think I did, but it was so far buried under the cloak of false sinfulness that I had been wrapped in against my will and then had begun to wear freely, or so it seemed, for all those years. And thus, babe in my arms, began my quest in earnest for a new faith. A new system of believing and being present in a world that surely looked like it needed saving most days. But maybe that's just because of where I was looking. A system of believing and being present in a world that surely still looks like it needs saving most days. But what if that's just because of where we're looking? What if grace is everywhere? And it's for the godly and the godless, believers and non-believers on every part of the gorgeous spectrum. And what if maybe there's nothing supernatural or relating to a benevolent deity about it at all? In chapter 5, verse 20 of the New Testament letter to the Romans, the Apostle Paul says, "Where sin abounds, grace does much more abound." Or maybe to take the baggage off of that, we could just use the words of Fred Rogers, when he invites us to watch the terrible news on our televisions through the filter of looking for the helpers. Where tragedy abounds, goodness and grace does much more abound. I believe it's true. I believe that the humanists among us are on to something with their good without God campaign, and it doesn't take much looking around to notice. I submit to you that maybe if grace is, as the dictionary defines, the unmerited favor of the divine, that we take a look at the divinity that resides in each of us and consider where we have been showing unmerited favor lately and to whom. When our heart is in a holy place, when our heart is in a holy place. We are blessed with love and amazing grace when our heart is in a holy place. Not because we finally humbled ourselves in sacred worship to a holy God who bestows upon us favor, but because our hearts are themselves the holiest of things, the source of the love and amazing grace with which we are so blessed. Look, I get it. Some days, many days, I do not feel very full of grace. Some days we get angry at each other, at the powers that be, at gods that we might not believe in. I said earlier that it's a precious gift to stand here not knowing what life situations are represented by our presence together in this place, and I hold this space reverently. And may I suggest that if you came here today mad, that you just go ahead and stay mad if you want to. I know that grace is still here because we are it. Be sad. That's okay. Grace says that's okay, and we will cry with you. Be convinced that grace doesn't exist and scream it out loud if you feel like it, and add all the swears that you can handle, because grace can handle that too. Because we are it, and we are not ever going to be freaked out by your humanness. We're relieved by it. It gives us space to be ourselves too. Grace surrounds you here in this space, and it doesn't have a dang thing to do with what you believe about the biggest questions, about life and death, about what comes next, gods, goddesses, sin, redemption. Grace doesn't care, because grace is in us. Grace is your brothers and sisters in this room who will hold your hand and love you through it, whatever it is, or give you space to stand apart from all the hand-holding, germ-sharing, and keep on loving you anyway. Grace, to me, was you, the people of the Unitarian Universalist Church of Rockford, who held my tiny baby the week after my screw Amazing Grace meltdown and told me how perfect she was and that you were glad to have us with you, and never once asked me how I got myself into this mess. Grace let us show up and be loved for months in this place without making a commitment of any kind, because we weren't sure where we belonged quite yet. But grace knew, and it waited for us. As I said earlier, I've been privileged to share versions of this grace message in several places, and this is the part of the sermon where I share a story that many of you have heard me share before. But one of the beautiful things about being here in my home church less frequently than I would like is that every time I come back, there are glorious new faces and people who don't know all my best stories yet. So for those of you who were not at her memorial service where I shared this for the first time, I want to tell you the story of my often disgruntled and always atheist friend Lee. I was working three jobs and about to begin another in a desperate attempt to keep my little girl and myself in an apartment I could not afford. Suddenly, without a running vehicle, and for lack of a stronger word, desperate for some help, Lee called me out of the blue on one of the very bad days and offered to loan me her car, which had a for sale sign in the window. And she offered to loan it to me until such a time as I could afford to purchase it from her for her asking price, or until it sold to another buyer. I thanked her profusely, to which she responded, "It's just sitting there. It's not doing anyone any good anyway. Can you come over here today and get it out of my way?" And so I did. And 1 week into my driving of Lee's car, she called me and said, "Hey, meet me at Lupros. We're getting the oil changed." And at her cost, she did. And then she filled it up with gas. Because, well, it would look pathetic on the side of the road, and someone might still recognize it as my car. My repeated thank yous were met with, "Well, you have to get to work somehow. Just be careful." So about 2 days afterwards, despite all my careful, I had an accident in that car, and I totaled it. And I wasn't kidding when I began this story by calling Lee disgruntled. She had a temper, very strong lungs, and she scared me half to death. So as you can imagine, that was the hardest phone call I ever convinced my sister to make in my life. Lee, as many of you know, was never one to hide her frustrations. She was inconvenienced and annoyed, downright angry at me, and she said so. But that's not the end of the story. After a day of recovery, I finally got up the nerve to go to her in person and apologize. "Forgiven, it's over," she said. "I promised to pay her what she had been asking for the car just as soon as I possibly could." "No, you won't," she said, "you're broke." "Well, yes, but I can make payments or save it up to pay you all in one." "No, you won't. Did I give you that car?" Unflinching stare into my eyes. "No, it was a loan. That's why I, exactly. It was my car to do with as I please. It still is, and I say you owe me nothing." She never mentioned another word to me about that car. We didn't become any closer of friends than we were before. Lee didn't do the right thing in order to be popular or make more friends. She already had fiercely loyal, wonderful friends. She didn't need you or me or her church or her political party or her family or her fellow committee members or choir members to agree with her. Lee did what was right simply because it was right. Because right is right no matter who agrees, and she embodied that deep knowing more than most. A life deeply rooted in right for the sake of right, as Lee lived hers, is about as full of grace as it gets. Grace is a word I'm pretty sure Lee didn't use, but she lived it anyway. And I felt her presence and the presence of grace itself when my daughter and I watched our state's governor stand on the side of love and sign marriage equality into law in Illinois shortly after Lee died. And then, again, when it became the law of land and the entire nation. I feel the presence of grace when we strive in our own cities toward greater compassion for our brothers and sisters who are immigrants and refugees who Lee would have taken in without hesitation. And as we do the work of racial justice in our schools for which she advocated. When girls like my daughter and Lee's granddaughter grow up never knowing anything but the dignity of choice and knowing they have a safe place and a village to support their precious young families, the work of grace will be entwined in the roots of their lives whether or not they ever call it by its name. We hear grace in the unwavering voices of our daughters when they stand boldly in their truth and with an unwavering gaze say no thank you to whatever their souls reject. We see grace in the strong, outstretched hands of our sons when they show up and say, "What can I do to help?" It is amazing grace that saved a soul like me by finally telling me that it was okay to never, ever, ever call myself that ugly, wretched word again. And to immediately tell my daughter to please substitute a better word in that lyric line if she ever sings that song. We're going to sing it together in a moment. If you want to go ahead and turn to page 205 in your gray hymnals, you can do that. You'll notice that the UUA beat me to the punch by putting an asterisk beside the word wretch and offering a different suggestion, which I had not noticed in all my years of singing that song from this hymnal until recently. So I too invite you to call yourself a soul in that part, not a wretch, or any other one-syllable word that makes you feel loved and valued just the way you are. Heck, stick as many syllables in as you'd like and sing it all kinds of wrong. This isn't American Idol. This is a space for grace, and your voice matters here exactly the way it is. No auto-tune, no edits. You'll be perfect. Sing it out loud. Because grace is just that amazing. Let's stand together, please. Embody your spirit and sing together, page 205.